This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Want to make a difference in your community but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
All right, everybody, while we wait for these speakers, I'm going to go ahead and jump in here and get us started with some of the introductions. And again, we may have more speakers joining later, but to start us off, we've got a lot of cybersecurity experts on this panel with decades of combined experience in the sector. And I'm really excited. I think I'm personally going to learn a lot today, and I think you guys will too. So starting us off, today's sponsor is Cybeats, a rapidly expanding cybersecurity company focused on software security solutions. They offer a software as a service product called the SBOM Studio, which scans software for vulnerabilities and threats, facilitates regulatory compliance by sharing SBOMs with government agencies, and provides a centralized tool for managing cyber risk. They've been providing services to U.S. infrastructure and Fortune 500 companies. The company's attempting to be positioned as a crucial player in the growing market for software safety and compliance, with the SBOM market expected to grow substantially. With us today, we have the CEO of Cybeats, Justin Ledger, as well as the president of Scribe, Clark Kent. How are you guys doing today?
Yeah, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Very well. Thanks. Thanks for having us.
Thank you both for being here. I think we're going to learn a lot today. And thanks again to Cybeats for sponsoring this panel. Wouldn't have it without them. Next, we've got Jackie Singh. Jackie is a freelance writer and technical expert in the field of information security. Jackie's held a number of significant roles in operational cybersecurity, including principal consultant at Mandiant and FireEye, global director of incident response at Intel Security and McAfee. She covers an array of topics such as cybercrime, privacy surveillance, and disinformation, and has a lot of great information on her newsletter and website called Hacking But Legal, which you should be subscribed to. Thank you for lending us your expertise today, Jackie.
It is my absolute pleasure. Thank you so much, Unusual Whales, for hosting this space, and shout out to Cybeats for hosting and for sponsoring, and to my fellow guest speakers, a big hello, and hello to all of you listening out there. That was an awesome intro. I think I don't need to add too much to it. I'm a cybersecurity professional and a writer who has a background in the military as a veteran and as a former defense contractor. I worked as the global director of incident response at Intel and McAfee on the Biden campaign in 2020 as the lead incident responder and threat analyst, and also as an anti-surveillance activist at the Surveillance Technology Oversight Project, which is a 501c3 nonprofit that focuses on abolishing and litigating against the government use of surveillance. But these days, I spend most of my time in private consulting, and I spend a lot of my time focusing on threats. So I'm noticing that our global threat environment is heating up in the prelude to the next US election. So I spend a lot of time talking about data privacy legislation and cyber threat intelligence. So really excited to be here today. Thank you so much for the intro, Unusual Wales.
Thank you so much for accepting. I mean, this panel, I think, is going to be very, very, very informative. I mean, you've all got really long tenureship in the field, and it's something that I personally don't know a ton about, so I'm pretty excited. So kind of to start us off here, let's just look at kind of like an overview of the topic cybersecurity here. In reference to business, a publication by McKinsey and Company highlights that nearly 80% of observed threat groups and more than 40% of observed malware in 2021 were previously unseen, so completely new. We've seen growing technological dependencies become more complicated and concentrated. Goldman Sachs has valued cybersecurity as one of the fastest growing fields. And kind of a question to start us off here with the full panel, how is the field growing? What's missing in the field? And how best do we capitalize on the growth of this field? Let's start with Jackie, and then I'll kick it over to both Justin and Clark.
Well, you weren't going to throw me a softball first, huh?
I got to start off exciting, you know?
Listen, that's a really tough question because we have to deconflict always in cybersecurity what the priorities truly are, right? When we think about cybersecurity, we're talking about a team sport, and we're talking about something that requires a greater level of coordination, visibility, and prioritization. And I think that's where a lot of organizations go wrong, is in simply not understanding what the right things are to do, what they should be tackling first, and in what order they should be tackling them. And it seems like that sense of confusion extends over our industry, right? We see folks talk about having many unfilled roles, lots of jobs that need to be filled in cybersecurity. But we also see unmet demand from the job seeker side. We're also seeing lots of layoffs in cybersecurity. So I think there has to be a continual right-sizing of cybersecurity, right? What are you doing? How are you doing it? And what are you spending on? But that should extend even wider out from the organization over the industry itself. I think we're going to start seeing a little bit more of a right sizing of the industry, especially as we witness the inclusion of AI to cybersecurity and how the impact of AI will entirely reshape that labor market. So it's a complicated question, but I hope I added some thoughts to it there.
You definitely did. And you touched on a number of topics that we're going to be getting to. Clark or Justin, do you have any comments there as well?
Yeah, I'll add to that. It is a constantly changing attack surface, right? You mentioned that there's a massive growth in vulnerabilities. In many cases, those are vulnerabilities that have always been there. And it's a lack of transparency into what's actually in the software that we use that keeps those vulnerabilities hidden. And to Jackie's point, we've got a lot of noise in the space, and actually prioritizing and managing how we're going to attack those. I can't solve every vulnerability in my software today, but maybe I can get to one, maybe I can get to five. And finding the signal in the noise is incredibly important, especially as that attack surface grows and changes, as we bring in new technologies. We've got to have tools and standards that are going to enable us to get to those really critical vulnerabilities that we've got to solve today.
I think Jackie and Justin, definitely hit the nail on the head on this. And there's, you could talk about it for hours or answer this question for hours. I think, being a generalist coming from the finance side, personally, cybersecurity is really as an industry is a bit of a moving target. It's obviously very complex. Cybersecurity is a keystroke. Security is something we all think of, or our passwords, but right down to securing the code on the devices that are in our houses, and the concerns around those as it relates to the global social economic kind of situation. It's massively complex. And for us ourselves at Cybeats or with the Cybeats product, this industry, this software supply chain industry or subsector in cybersecurity is one that's, you know, really budding for the first time. The government and industry is starting to talk about, okay, what's actually in the software that's on all these devices that we're wearing? We're walking around, we wake up in the morning, we're next to five devices, they're all connected, they're all gathering information. We get in our cars, we drive to Starbucks, we join there, we pay with our phones, we go back to the office. During COVID, everybody, you know, all of these workers in every industry brought their work home and were then kind of, you know, forced to bring certain, devices in and out of different places. And we, until very recently, just the last few years, have started to care about what's actually on the software. Where's it coming from? And so it's a very, very wide topic, cybersecurity. And I think people, you know, as individuals, are behind on understanding exactly what it entails and how it is affecting them or can affect them as citizens.
Thank you all. Really good explanations there. And I think I kind of want to delve a little further into kind of the same topic and spin it toward kind of the demand for cybersecurity solutions. Because in that same release that McKinsey did, they noted as well that the currently available commercial solutions don't necessarily fully meet customer demands. Now, I'm wondering, and this will be again to the whole panel, we'll maybe start with Clark, Justin, then Jackie here. In your opinion, what are some of the key shortcomings of current safeguards, and how would these need to further develop to meet the demand of rising threats?
I guess I'll jump in if nobody else will. Again, Nick, I think it comes back to exactly what part of the problem or of cybersecurity are we talking about? In the case, I mean, really the most important thing, I think, if you talk to, and we've got several people on the panel here that have backgrounds in, certainly in cybersecurity, dealing with the government and the top of the food chain in that. It really comes down to, for us, what do we play a role in? Well, we're looking at the code that's on all of the devices or we're providing a product that allows companies to keep track of the code that's on all of their products so that as they change, open source code changes, they have a record of what that is and where those vulnerabilities might be. But that's not a problem that a consumer or, other businesses that are not manufacturing software solutions can solve. That's a problem only for the manufacturers. So, when you start talking about the demand, I mean, right now, what's driving what we're doing is these are brand new mandates.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
That have came out in the last couple of years from the federal government in the U.S. saying, look, for the first time, we're going to force companies starting with the big manufacturers in the more sensitive, areas like healthcare and finance. We're going to force you to keep track of your software instead of that being a black hole of whatever your developers are putting on it. We're going to force that. So with the FDA recently coming out and enforcing this actual SBOM compliance, now you just have a wave of companies trying to catch up. And so from our perspective, that's just one little tiny sector of the industry in supply chain security. That doesn't address what Jackie does and what the others on the panel do.
There are massive gaps, and I would love to hear Jackie's perspective. I'm obsessed with transparency in software. So as we know, software is made up of lots of different components and libraries, much of it open source. In many cases, it's over 90% of software is open source software. And developers will tell you they don't know what's not in every line of code. They don't know what vulnerabilities are necessarily there. When they come up, it gets flagged and that information gets shared. But there's lots of traps lying in wait. And trying to identify those and prioritize those and tackle those, I think, is a big gap that exists today. And developers have, and software consumers that track vulnerabilities, they've got so much information coming at them in terms of what vulnerabilities are there. They need a way to be able to prioritize that. That's what we're tackling. We're looking at a way to try to manage the vulnerability lifecycle. We're leveraging a new standard called Software Bill of Materials, or SBOM, that's essentially an ingredients list for what's in your software. And as Clark mentioned, it's been mandated by government, in some cases, very specifically, within the medical device industry. FDA has said that you will submit software bills of material for your new medical devices to get approved. We recently saw the NSA come out with guidance for implementing SBOM. We actually got mentioned within that document, which was kind of neat for us. We also have seen at the federal level a mandate, a requirement that if you wish to do business with the United States government at any level, or at the federal level rather, you need to submit a software bill of materials for any device or software that is going to be procured. And that came through executive order a few years ago. So there's major push for increased transparency. And it's kind of an interesting concept when you think about it, that we're going to increase security through transparency. Often you're trying to protect data and put it in a little box and hope that nobody ever sees it. But this is kind of taking a different approach through more information and more sharing of information. And I think certainly what we're seeing is a huge demand, particularly like the bigger the company, the more complex their environment, there's a bigger demand for a means of managing all of this information and actually finding the useful intelligence out of it. Jackie?
Yeah, I want to segue this a little bit too, Jackie. Actually, I'm curious, Jackie, your comments on the changing requirements in the software side for government, given your background, Jackie.
Yeah, I could touch on everything that Clark and Justin just mentioned. I mean, I think it's really important to talk about SBOM within the context of organizations prioritizing and sharing information, and like ultimately one of the things that's going to help us in cybersecurity, as I mentioned, it's a team sport, is reducing silos. Today, many different organizations create many different improvements to cybersecurity data sets, to cybersecurity products and tools, and they do this internally, and they don't share as much as they could or should, in my opinion. And so the opportunity to reduce silos is enabled by something like a software bill of materials, because what we're really talking about is exactly what Justin just said. How do we increase transparency? How do we ensure that the vast lines of third-party code, of open source code, something that came from an organization outside of the one that produced the product, which every organization today relies on third-party code, open source code. It's actually shocking to find out how much we do. But even in the case of products like, say, SolarWinds, I think one of the major reasons and impetus for the federal government to push forward with this executive order for cybersecurity is a sense, through growing awareness of incidents like the SolarWinds hack, that there are some problems in the space that we need to remedy from a position of shifting left. Shifting left is the perspective that there are issues that affect us individually as people. There are issues that affect corporations, right? There are issues that affect communities. But many of the issues that end up affecting us all the way down that chain originated much farther up the chain, you know, in some kind of organization or in a relationship between organizations that might have been missing or incorrect or was never created, that would help the community overall to realize that a coordination problem exists, right? So when we talk about SBOMs, we're sharing information about how our systems are constructed, how our products are constructed, in order to give everyone a greater visibility into what the potential problems or vulnerabilities might be with that particular software, right? In the case of SolarWinds, hackers gained access to this tech company in 2019. And my immediate recollection was late 2019. And then they proceeded to run around in this tech company's network for quite some time after that, maybe 6-8 months or something after that. And during this time, they were able to create what's called a supply chain compromise. They were able to modify software, which was then downloaded by customers of this company, which then created many secondary and tertiary negative effects. And so in order to prevent those second and third order effects that end up affecting people like us all the way down the chain, people who don't have the ability to necessarily influence these things from a larger scale, we lose the ability to protect ourselves as a country and as communities and as organizations. So the greater amount of coordination that we can engage in, the reduction of silos, the shifting left, all of these things work together to improve what we do procedurally in cybersecurity.
I'd just like to add there, it's very easy, you know, the guys that are on the call here, Justin, Jackie and myself, obviously we work in the industry, so we're very close to the topic. So it's very easy once we get, you know, on a platform like this to start getting into the minutiae and forgetting that a lot of the people that are, you know, most of the audience, you know, we're probably talking way over their head, within the first three sentences. The bottom line is, which I found out with what we've done here, at Cybeats, is that all of the devices, all of the code, all of the everything around you that has software on it, chances are the majority of the software that's sitting on whatever device that is, and this, you know, your TV, your watch, whatever it is, your connected security system, over 70%, it's very likely over 70% of the code on that device came from open source, meaning when that product was developed, and this is by the big companies too, this is not a little company thing, it's an industry across the industry. When you're, and I'm not going to say any individual brand because I don't want to be sued, but when your TV, whatever major manufacturer, when that's developed, 70 to probably 90% of the code on that TV was taken from the internet, from out there in cyberspace. Probably not that much is known about where the code started. It might have been from earlier versions of that TV, but we're talking about code literally that has just been taken off the internet and stuck on that device. And obviously, you know, as we talk and as we started, and you hear, you know, every day now, you know, cybersecurity, it's you can't get away from it. Easy to foresee that these old components, software components taken off the internet, are going to have over time, they're going to break down, or you're going to have hackers who are going to figure out how to manipulate them, and they're going to get in. They're going to listen to you, or they're going to, you know, control your car. They're going to do whatever that is. But literally, I just think it's an important thing to highlight just how crazy that is. I think to the average person, I don't think would know, oh yeah, yeah, that code was not developed by insert big, they're just whipped off the internet, you know, and up until very recently, that organization may not have even had a record of the code that's on that specific, you know, model of your TV. So I just want to back that up as kind of the guy that's the late joiner into the industry. I found that as a consumer just absolutely wild.
So kind of to just touch on that a little bit, just, you know, the common knowledge that I think would be required for this sector in general. And for our listeners here, for those who don't know, Justin Clark or Jackie, anyone feel free. Could you kind of describe what SBOM is and why it's important to our listeners?
Yeah, certainly. I'll take this one. SBOM is a standard, Software Bill of Materials. And this was developed jointly between...
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously. Your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend, or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Industry and government, led by the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, they came up with a methodology and documentation standards for identifying software components, libraries, licenses, dependencies, basically all the building blocks of software. And the SBOM, the closest analogy that I've been able to come up with is that of a food label, or an ingredients list, rather. It tells you what's in it. You have some sense of where it came from. Like it's, we can't imagine buying food and not knowing where it came from, or having confidence that somebody knows where it came from. So if it's, you know, got arsenic in it, you'd be able to find out, okay, where it came from, how did it get there, where was it sold, and what, how do we get it off the shelves, and how do we inform people that, so they don't consume it. Software, which I would say is just as important to our, certainly our modern society, we don't have that same kind of visibility. So SBOM can give us that. And to Jackie's point around sharing, it's really essential that we have a standard way. Not that we do our own little thing and come up with our bespoke solution, but that there's a way to share this information broadly. I'll call it a specific example. There, within different industries, there are things called information sharing and analysis centers. These are like peer-to-peer intelligence sharing communities. And the Health ISAC recently started a project with CyBeats to help improve that information sharing with regard to software vulnerabilities at the industry level. So, you know, this wouldn't have been possible without something like SBOM, certainly not at the same scale and across industries. So SBOM is very transformational. I think it's very akin to, yeah, that mandate to put food labels on food way back in whenever the 19th century or whenever that was.
Yeah. Or, I mean, you know, another thing, taking it back, as an analogy, I mean, so SBOM, what does it stand for? The S is for software. The bomb is bill of materials. I think as long as anybody, probably anybody listening to this, and certainly the people on this panel or discussion, as long as we've been alive, auto manufacturers have had to have a bill of materials where they know, if a hood latch is manufactured in a certain facility in Korea or wherever it is, what batch that hood latch comes from, what factory it comes from, you know, what time that was done, what alloy that specific, you know, component piece of the car is supposed to consist of. so that, you know, later on the car's out the cars get out into the market and it's found that, okay, there's a problem with a specific, batch of hood latches where they're the alloy's off, whatever it is, bad analogy. I'm the dumb guy here, example, but, you have a recall, you bring the car in and they know exactly, to some degree, which cars are out there in the market that may have that hood latch. Well, that's what SBOM is essentially for software. It's you now have to have a bill of materials. You got to have a list of the components, and you can think about these software components like bricks, bricks in a wall. You have to have a list of the that version of software on that car. That's what the SBOM is. So it's Software Bill of Materials, SBOM, and it's just a standard way of displaying or of listing the components, the bill of materials, inside a device or a software. So it's these analogies sometimes we get so used to using them without really breaking it down or explaining, but it's very simple. And in fact, as I say, I think most people would be surprised that we're just talking about this now in the last, 3 years, 4 years. We're really talking about forcing this, having a record of these things. That's what that is. But Jackie and Justin will probably come on and say I was totally wrong. I'm way off the mark.
No way. You're totally right.
I was gonna say, hey, man, the dumb guy title, that one's reserved for me today.
I'll tell you, I will challenge you all day on that, Nick. We're going to be neck and neck on that one. Being facetious in that point, but it's quite wild, with us and with what's happened with the company. I'll just tell you, shameless plug here, but really, our guys, we acquired a cybersecurity company. With a few brilliant guys behind it who are developing, we found that within the first kind of, let's say 90 days of acquiring the company and kind of onboarding the team, the guys collectively came up with a concept of how we could leverage this and bet on the potential for the government to adopt this SBOM. This goes back, a little over 18 months ago. And we said, the guy said, look, we have an infrastructure that we can take advantage of. It's a bit of a punt. We don't know if the government's going to do this. There was an executive order or a couple executive orders out from Trump over his term. But when Biden came in, it was really, nobody knew, what was going to happen. We took a punt on that. The guys got developing. We made this product. I couldn't believe personally that this didn't exist in the market. And I will tell you, Nick, we didn't, we got very fortunate. We built the product and literally, like clockwork. Biden came out with an executive order, really aggressive. Jackie was probably behind it. She probably made it happen. So we owe her big time. We got to get her stock options. But Biden came out, announced this SBOM executive order, and a very aggressive tone around it. We were not even done the product. I think we put out that we had a beta at that point. And the phone rang and it was a Fortune 500 company or 100 company saying, look, we'd like to try your product. And we had our first client before the product was done, signed on, which was a top five multinational company. That's how recent this whole mandate is. In the last 24 months, companies are starting to adopt this. So that's kind of the you know, the catch up for us. Something so simple, everybody gets lost in how technical cybersecurity is. This is not all that technical. It's a matter of knowing what is in what we're consuming, and we consume more software than we do potato chips now. And the software is coming from, you know, those potato chips are coming from factories that we know nothing about.
So one thing I want to touch on, especially given, you know, the concept that that was a pretty firmly held executive order with firm language, Jackie, just in general, kind of what do you see as the most misunderstandings in the space itself? Now, like in the current U.S. administration, for example, or even other administrations across the world, are governments in general kind of adept enough to deal with the growing vectors of attacks?
I think from an offensive perspective, governments are doing pretty well. From a defensive perspective, not so much. You know, like there's a fig leaf, you know, it's like, oh, we're being attacked. But there isn't a lot of conversation about what we're doing offensively. So it's a little funny there. You know, the truth is people don't have an innate sense of cyber risk the same way that we understand physical risk. So when we talk about these executive orders and the impetus that the federal government has to do something on cybersecurity, to do something effective, there tends to be a long arc of time there with regard to safety and security implementation. So it's really heartening to hear that Cybeats has been successful in kind of moving that forward and presenting solutions that align with the problem set that we have, right? In general, the longer time that a software has existed, especially without updates, the more likely it is to be vulnerable, whether intentionally or unintentionally, right? Whether those bugs came as a result of a complexity in the code, there's some parts of the code that interact with each other that produce a condition at some point that could, you know, lead someone to have a problem. Or it could be an intentional insertion of a bug, right? I think there's been some allusion to that on the call today. And generally speaking, older code and legacy programming languages and frameworks are much more vulnerable compared to newer frameworks. But a lot of that legacy stuff underpins our internet today and underpins a lot of the technology that we use today. And it's important to recognize that resourced actors, right, national level actors, I don't say nation state because that's not an accurate geopolitical label or description, right? We're talking about real countries that are not in some state of establishment, they're established nations. And they spend a lot of money to put professional hackers like me in buildings where they do nothing but sit around all day and think about how to exploit vulnerable software. And the more people that use it, or the more people that are targeted, organizations that are specifically targeted that use it, the more likely it is that there are more people thinking about how to exploit it. And with all of that said, complexity and the human factors of cyber certainly make all of that worse. So the transparency that people like.
Want to make a difference in your community, but not sure how? Go to GoFundMe.com right now and start a GoFundMe. Seriously, your next fundraiser doesn't have to start in a school parking lot or a church basement. You can start a GoFundMe today in just minutes. Fundraise for yourself, a friend or family member, or an organization. All that matters is that you care about them. GoFundMe is the trusted place to fundraise for what you care about. With no pressure to hit your fundraising goal, but tons of tools to help you reach it, you can confidently start fundraising right now. Whether it's creative, local, or critical, your cause matters. And there's a reason why GoFundMe is backed by millions and chosen by fundraisers everywhere. It works, and it matters. GoFundMe helps you make a real difference. Start your GoFundMe today at GoFundMe.com. That's GoFundMe.com. GoFundMe.com. This is a commercial message brought to you by GoFundMe.
Me and certainly Justin and Clark are looking for in the industry, it helps all of us who focus on those types of problems to do the work of reducing our own organizational risk and protecting all of us overall a little bit easier. So just a shout out to all of the topics that have been discussed so far, because they're really important. You know, it can be easy as a cybersecurity pro to think like, oh, that's, you know, it's just a product. But what we're talking about is a product that enables a procedure, that enables a process, a methodology that everyone needs to pick up to be safer and realistically to just reduce their own risk. I mean, the SolarWinds hack was extremely negative for them as a company. And I don't think any organization wants to think that there's something that they fail to do that then led to a measurable increase in risk or actual harm to either their customers or some other unintended third party. So really valuable. This executive order, from my opinion, from my perspective, it signals that we've got to make the federal government system stronger and safer. Important to note that even 15 years ago, when I was working as a defense contractor and managing my own systems, I had to keep very careful track of what it was that I was using, how I was using it. There was an ATO authorization process that essentially broke out these materials, but it didn't do so in a way that was as structured as the SBOM process. So I think all of these things that we're driving in the executive order are really valuable. We're also talking about reporting cyber incidents and doing so in a way that is timely, because if we don't report the incidents in a manner that is timely, we may not be able to help other affected people. Removing weird barriers, contractual barriers, or you know whatever those barriers might be to sharing information, so that we can break down those silos. I think that's all super valuable, right? These are all matters of national security from my perspective. And I think that perspective is shared at the federal government today, which is really a relief for me as a cybersecurity pro.
Jackie, 100%, yeah. 100%. I have a prediction, and I don't know whether or not it's something I dreamed up or it's something that somebody told me, but I'll tell you that I believe very firmly within the next 15 years, one of the attributes or factors of defining the values as being a citizen or the security of being a citizen of a certain country or region is going to be defined by how secure they are from a cybersecurity perspective. Because what we sometimes gloss over is it important if your refrigerator that has on your Wi-Fi that you can whatever manage your applications your appliances in your house with, does it matter if those are hacked? Is somebody going to mess with my dishes and wash them more and waste time and energy and whatever? That's not the problem. The problem is that those devices sit on a network, and that network interacts with other devices that you have that have sensitive information on them. And everything about our finances, our health, our citizenship, all the crucial details of being a citizen, of being a human being living in wherever you're living, the US or Canada, it's all exposed sitting on these networks. And if one of those little chips, one of those little things that you join, your car, the coffee shop at Starbucks, whatever it is, if one of those are not secure and you end up with a piece of software on your phone that comes back into your network, you got a big problem. And that could be, your identity theft. It could be all these things. But to add to Jackie's, talk about offensive versus defensive, one of the most I would say eye-opening conversations that I've had since working in this industry is I spoke with a very high level individual about what's going on behind closed doors at the federal level, and what are they doing, and how are things working and whatever. And it's his opinion that the only way that you can secure the country really is by, number one, securing, making sure that we know what's on all these devices, we know what's on our code, and number two, then making sure that these devices actually all have security on them, from medical devices to, your car to all these things. That's the only way you can really secure. What he shared with me was, infrastructure-wise, in doing tests over a period of time, and I'm just being careful in what I share, but it doesn't take a whole lot for an external, enemy to come in and shut down, certain infrastructures. And now these could be, temporary impacts, but they're open. It's not just private businesses. Jackie, I'm sure, because she comes from that side, is you know, maybe dancing around certain points, not wanting to say things. I'm the guy that'll probably end up, you know, on the news disappearing or something, obviously joking, but no, it's a major, major issue as it comes down, boils down to us as secure citizens, health, money, citizenship, travel, security in general. It is a extremely critical thing that I think, you know, the majority of the population probably never pays mind to. You know, they're worried about COVID, putting a mask on, but they're walking around with a bunch of stuff that may compromise their, you know, their health or their family by not. And let me be straight. Most of these problems, certainly the problems that we address, they're not problems that you as an individual can solve. This is about big industry, big organizations taking account of their software. And by the way, what's happened since putting SBOM, the software bill of materials into place, is it's also been found to be a best practice. Companies are actually adopting. We have clients now that are coming on that have nothing to do with any regulated market. They're not from the FDA. They're not from whatever. Maybe they're in crypto. Maybe they're in gaming. Maybe they're in other things. And they're adopting SBOM. There's a lot of markets. There's a few big regions around the world that have already adopted SBOM because you actually, this might blow everybody away. But if you keep a record of your software and you keep on top of that, you keep your product safer. You have a better product. You save money by not having to plug holes later, and you're more efficient. Like who would think that by keeping a record of what's on your product would work? But it does. So it's an ongoing threat every day, and it's going to be this SBOM is a huge wave. Since we started, we developed this product in 18 months. We basically went from a concept to our first year commercial within 18 months, literally walking and chewing gum in the beginning at, having our first clients that were, several, tens of billion dollar companies. Our first clients come in while we're finishing the product and while we're raising money as a small startup to support it. The wave has just started. I can tell you this industry is, on an SBOM perspective, it's exploding. The FDA in, I think it was, what was it, Justin? Was it September, October came in and
it was October.
Yeah. And can you detail that? Cause I think that's the proofs in the pudding there with the FDA doing what they're doing. Can you detail what that was? I think it's, related to having SBOMs in order to get FDA approval.
Yes. For new medical devices that need approval by the FDA, there's a requirement to submit a software bill of materials. And it, like you say, Clark, it's not just on the regulatory side, right? It's just best business practice. We've got analysts saying that within the next couple of years, it's 60% of organizations acquiring software, particularly mission critical software, are going to require SBOM submission. So to Jackie's earlier point, connecting the dots, sharing this intelligence, trying to create that transparency through information sharing is one of the critical paths. It's on the critical path to securing everything.
So I'm curious, just kind of on that same topic of, defensive posturing against any kind of cyber attacks. Kind of at the current rate of growth, I think they're projecting that damage from cyber attacks will amount to about $10.5 trillion annually by 2025. And that's something like a 300% increase from, a decade prior, 2015 levels. Is it possible to keep up with that? And I guess kind of just in your opinion, we'll start with Jackie here. Why is it that it took so long to mandatorily implement this kind of protection like the SBOM you've spoken about?
That's a great question. Like I said, I don't think most people have an innate sense of cyber risk in the same manner as we understand physical risk. And we also perceive the risk of individual targeting to be really low, which is usually correct, as the resourcing costs needed to target a single individual remain fairly high, but we're still unable to prioritize and identify the riskiest behaviors, the most risky behaviors that we engage in that could lead us to become targeted through our own inadvertent actions, right? So for example, understanding the difference between, say, locking your front door at night and keeping your firewall on. You know, the truth is that the TCP/IP protocol that runs the internet accounts for more than 65,000 ports or doors to each system using it. And people aren't aware of that.
Colmena Seguros presenta una historia imparable.
Cuando uno de mis trabajadores sufrió un accidente en la empresa, sentí miedo. Pensaba en él, en su familia y en todo lo que podía pasar. Pero la verdad, ese miedo duró poco, porque Colmena Seguros estuvo a nuestro lado, guiándonos y acompañándonos para que la recuperación fuera más rápida. Hoy mi empresa sigue adelante, con la tranquilidad y respaldo de Colmena.
Colmena Seguros, la aseguradora de las empresas que no paran de salir adelante.
Vigilado Superintendencia Financiera de Colombia. Colmena Seguros, una empresa de Fundación Grupo Social.
Or that some varied code bases are actively waiting for the right knock or handshake to engage in some kind of communication that could let someone into your home without your knowledge. You know, so there's a gap between our lay person's understanding of what the threat landscape truly is and what that looks like, and the understanding of how negative, harmful situations were contributed to by a risky cybersecurity posture. Does that make sense? And so as a cybersecurity pro, as someone who, you know, helped advise companies that are Fortune 1000 level organizations about what they should be doing from a cyber perspective, it's all about preparation and getting ahead of problems. But the reality is that we're not always successful as cybersecurity pros in convincing companies to take the actions that they need to take, because the resourcing that we're asking them to engage in, the amount of man hours, right, labor, people, and just budget that it takes to successfully pull off a cybersecurity program often seems out of step or out of sync with the actual risk. And so we tend to often wait for something really bad, like the SolarWinds hack, to happen, which causes a sea change in the industry that creates a realization that is completely cultural, that things have to change. And we have some ideas about how to get them to change. And that's what we've got to work on and spend all our time working on. So again, it's just a long arc with regard to safety and security. You could look up the history of the seatbelt, for example, to get a sense of how long it took to get a seatbelt implemented. You know, it can be one human lifetime or so before we get from risk and understanding that risk and having an innate sense of it to being able to, say, lock our doors, to turn on our firewall, and to consider it rote practice as a normal thing that we do.
Jackie, just given your background, obviously working at the tip top of cybersecurity, what do you attribute the tardiness to? Is it just, you know, that's how the government works, to, you know, getting these things going and paying attention defensively? Is it just, you know, big wheels turn slow and these guys, you know, they're not up there at the podium, you know, getting votes by talking about how they're going to secure, our devices? What do you kind of see? What can you say about that?
I think that we have some low level of technical understanding amongst our elected officials, generally speaking. And I think that is often reflected in the hearings that we've been seeing, where we have tech CEOs showing up to justify or, you know, explain, have a conversation about some harms that elected officials are complaining about and bringing to them from their constituents. And you get the sense that they aren't really involved enough in the digital sphere to truly get a sense of either how that impacts us, or for the ones that do understand how it impacts us, they don't have the hands-on experience. And so they still are one level removed from the day-to-day lives that many Americans have, where we live our lives digitally. We use digital services all day, every day. And, you know, many of us do that to varying degrees, but the reality is that complexity is increasing. The access that people have to broadband is increasing. The number of malware samples every day is increasing. The number of ransomware attacks are increasing. The offensive incursions from other countries and, you know, countries engaging in cyber situations that don't rise to the level of a war declaration. We're just seeing more and more of that. And the opportunity, I think, is just to expand awareness, to continue expanding awareness amongst these people and to elect people who are willing to take advice from those who are not lobbyists. There are many lobbyists in Washington who do not necessarily have our best interests at heart, who, you know, I'm sorry, Cybeats, but they sometimes come from, they come from the big tech companies. Like I'm thinking, you know, like OpenAI, I'll throw a name out there, right? As an example of a CEO who visited Washington in order to lobby for his company and succeeded very much in shifting the elected officials' general public perception of AI, what the product capabilities are, what the future is for it, and to get them to sit up and take notice. And, you know, I think that kind of reactivity is partly driven by trends in the electorate and what it is that we pay attention to. You know, I don't think that we don't ask enough of our elected officials in the positions that they're in and the paychecks that they make and the photo ops that they get. You know, some of these folks are not necessarily doing the right things from a policy and a governance perspective that are going to help move us forward. And so it really becomes about getting away from the chaos. You know, you mentioned Donald Trump, right? We've got Joe Biden who came in. That was a chaotic situation, just shifting from an R to a D. If we do it again, it'll be, you know, even more complex. We're having issues with transition, with handover. How do we reduce tribalism in order to increase that transparency, to reduce the siloing, to work together as closely as we can to shift left? We can't do that without bipartisanship.
Jackie, you know, it's funny you say that because the guy that or the person that I was mentioning before that was telling me the story about you know, working and basically running simulations at the, you know, the tip top level about going to cyber war with certain places and not getting results back that you want. He was there through or he or she or whatever was there through both administrations. And I asked him, but so, you know, you're there through both administrations. You've got Trump, who obviously spends a lot of money in that area or supports that. And then you've got, you know, you've got the other side that comes in, you know, there must be some change. And, you know, their feedback was, yeah, there was no change at all. It on both of them, it was like, you know, pushing a boulder uphill. You know, there's nothing sexy yet about talking about what our officials or what the guys that are supposed to be working for us are doing to make us safer from that perspective. And actually today I was talking with somebody and they referred to Log4j as like a 9/11 moment for software. And it's true. You know, it's probably a pretty good analogy when you consider it. But you know, the issue is, you know, I would say 99.5 out of 100 people that you talk to have no idea what that is. Jackie, can you say anything about Log4j? Or, you know, were you familiar with that situation? I'd imagine that's
yeah. Log4j was one of these open source tools that we talk about corporations bringing into their environments, right? It's like a logging framework that allowed developers to log information, and some of that data could be user input, which is problematic. But essentially, there was a vulnerability in it that involved arbitrary code execution. Arbitrary code execution is kind of your worst category. It's when you can make software completely ignore its own process and what it was trying to do, and to execute your own code as the attacker, your own code, which is malicious instead. And so, you know, the vulnerability is really old. It was really old. It had been around for like, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years or something before it was identified.
And the big story there was, the big story there was you had, you know, tier one companies, blue chip companies coming out and saying, you know, because there was a mad rush to figure out, okay, who has this, mm-hmm. Who's exposed. Mm-hmm. And you had them saying publicly, yeah, you know, we've got our engineers on it, but we're not exactly sure if we have that in our products or if we have that. Mm. That. I think that was like, if you put that in the context of, you know, we hear about, whatever E. coli in our, whatever we're buying, you've got a recall of food. If one of our, food manufacturers came back and said, you know, we really don't know where these cows came from or where this beef came from.
Oh, man.
I think there'd be a lot of people going, okay, holy shit. Like, what world are we living in? How does this company, how would that company survive? And yet that was pretty standard practice there. We're not sure where what code we got, what we're exposed to. I mean, you'd be drawn and quartered in any other industry. Hyundai cannot have parts of their car that they've got off the back of a truck, somewhere. They don't know where it came from. I think that, like, we just let that happen. That Log4j was important to people that understand what it is. It was a non-issue and a complete, non-story for everybody else.
Yeah, absolutely. It wasn't anything that the folks on the street were walking around talking about. You know, the element of state sponsorship obviously isn't anything that regular folks are tracking. And that's just, the geopolitical aspect of cybersecurity just makes it even more complicated. But if you were to explain to regular folks, how this vulnerability could impact them, it could literally imply that their systems can be taken over by anyone who is interested in using their technology capabilities for something else. So whether that's your system's power, right? The capabilities that you have on your system itself, the electricity that you have in your home, the bandwidth pipe that you have to your home, all of those are a valuable resource. And what bad guys often do is amass many large, quote unquote, botnets of these kind of zombie systems that are comprised of, like, grandma's cable modem and mom's Roku device, right? These are all systems that, given.
Colmena Seguros presenta una historia imparable.
Cuando uno de mis trabajadores sufrió un accidente en la empresa, sentí miedo. Pensaba en él, en su familia y en todo lo que podía pasar. Pero la verdad, ese miedo duró poco, porque Colmena Seguros estuvo a nuestro lado, guiándonos y acompañándonos para que la recuperación fuera más rápida. Hoy mi empresa sigue adelante, con la tranquilidad y respaldo de Colmena.
Colmena Seguros, la aseguradora de las empresas que no paran de salir adelante.
Vigilado Superintendencia Financiera de Colombia. Colmena Seguros, una empresa de Fundación Grupo Social.
The same level of access to your home network as, say, your home PC would. So they get to do whatever they want with them. And if you happen to be someone who is a little bit more targeted, maybe you're an activist, maybe you're a journalist, maybe you're a politician, maybe you write on sensitive issues. For whatever reason, you've got a Rolodex that's attractive to others. You could find yourself on a very large list of systems that have been automatically exploited using a vulnerability like Log4Shell, which related to the Log4j software.
So have you, Jackie, have you moved, from your in your situation, have you moved, into the private market? Do you find that there's more momentum there, to actually make change than there is working, for the powers that be?
No, not so much. Not so much, to be frank with you. I see a lot of the same conversations at cybersecurity companies again and again, that are, just a little boring to me personally as a cybersecurity professional, because it doesn't feel like there's a state of the art technology advancement in cybersecurity. It feels like most of the work that we need to do is procedural and methodological and focused on improving our labor force and right-sizing our labor force.
What I want to do, and hopefully we can get Justin back in here as well to kind of touch on this too, but we were touching a little bit on, kind of the topic of moving forward now that companies are at least starting to implement what I think is pretty clear at this point in the discussion should have been implemented, decade or two ago, probably. But I'm curious from the Cybeats perspective, kind of more how more how businesses are utilizing SBOMs now and kind of how specifically SBOM Studios being utilized, especially given I saw that Sybeach just released new news today about a 3-year contract that was signed with a medical device manufacturer. So I'm kind of curious how, kind of moving forward, how things like SBOM Studio are being utilized and how you see the trajectory this year and years forward. We'll start here with Clark of SBOM Studio.
Yeah, I'm happy to do so. I see that that he's working on trying to join again. But you know, so the journey with this has been obviously Biden came out with a very aggressive you know mandate, which certainly helped our business. You know, the initial wave was crazy. The background here is so Scribe. We are, you know, I guess what you'd call a venture builder. We're a small team, kind of techno-commercial team that looks at opportunities, you know, higher risk type stuff you know, in emerging markets that you know, could we could take advantage of using our background, which is, you know, we've got a team that has been developing a platform that has elements of AI and we'll call it data collection and other kind of aspects within that space. We look to deploy with you know, in different verticals. With Sybeach, we really, I mean, this company, we literally acquired it within 3 months. You know, had this concept of utilizing the platform to build something for SBOM and what we do, you know, very simply, or what Sybeach does, speaking as the parent co.
Yeah, so I'll give you a little context about that one. Obviously, the client doesn't want us to name them. Otherwise, I would so happily name them because you definitely all know it and probably buy their products. But obviously, security, right? They don't always want people to know what capabilities they have on the cyber front, notwithstanding the transparency argument. But that company was previously a client of ours. You know, they're one of the biggest companies in the world. We started working with them last year, and they bought a 1-year license from us. You know, new company, new capability. Let's see how it goes. And yeah, over the last couple of months, we've been talking to them about expanding their license and extending that for a further 3 years. So they used us for a year, and they just bought another 3. Which is huge validation of the product, in my opinion, huge validation of the team, huge validation of the concept of software bill of materials. And I think it's a very strong indicator about where this is going. As I mentioned earlier, we're at a point in the market right now where it's those large companies with complex requirements, regulatory requirements that need what we have. Like, they genuinely need it. You know, when you have product market fit, it feels like you're being pulled. That's what's happening right now. But I think what we're going to see over time is that smaller companies that just want to have good cyber hygiene are going to be implementing. It's not ever going to be something that the end user or end consumer needs to worry about, I don't think, but it's very likely as we see further supply chain attacks like Log4j, like SolarWinds, that people are going to want to know that the folks that are providing them with their software, with their devices, have taken steps to secure that supply chain. So, yeah, it's a growing market, and somehow Sybeach, you know, through a bit of luck and lots of hard work and, you know, and the experience of our team, have been able to position ourselves pretty effectively to take, you know, to leverage that amazing growth. So it's looking very good on the commercial front. Really, it's a matter of awareness and getting the word out there that we've got the solution for this problem. If I sound a bit harried, it's because, you know, I'm run off my feet here. I go from call to call with client to client. It's pretty exciting.
It's been speaking as a shareholder, obviously, but it's been a very hectic process in that, you know, the company went from a venture built, working under Scribe, building the asset, the commercial part of the company exploded. Scribe is a development company. We have nothing to do with commercial opportunity or commercial activity. And overnight, we found ourselves, you know, servicing the biggest companies in the world. I think Cybeats, within our first 6 months of being commercial, which was, the product wasn't even done yet. I think we had, three, four contracts. As Justin was mentioning, you're talking about, multi billion dollar companies, household names, literally a team of developers and a small, small commercial infrastructure. So, where the company from a macro perspective is going is, we've been very fortunate that, the market at large, and this is why I was asking Jackie, just kind of what she's noticed, within our tiny little sector, which is the subsector under Cybeats, the companies there, there's been an explosion of M&A activity, an explosion of capital raise, valuations that, obviously were incredibly attractive for us as investors, developers to get involved, because this is like a market at its infancy. This is one day the world waking up and saying, we've got to keep track of what's in our software. And as part of that, there's a million little logistics issues that come with that. The bigger the company, the bigger the problem, the more SBOMs, the more records to manage, and the more crucial. And so with Cybeats now, we spun the company out. The company went public on its own just over a year ago. We did a capital raise with that, which was really like to get the company on its feet to get into commercial operation. We just ended our first kind of real year of commercial activity. Now, since September, we've seen this boom of medical device companies going crazy. I think we're close to having, I don't want to over, obviously none of this is investment advice and all that stuff because we are a public company. So the disclaimer is there. But you go out, you read the news, as a company, because we've been, we're a small cap company. I think, and in talking with, investors and especially in the US side, they go, it's incredible. I mean, how is there a tiny little company that whose client list is the biggest companies in the world and nobody's heard, heard the company's name? So for us right now, we're working at servicing the clients that we have, onboarding the bigger companies. We just closed a small capital raise for the company, a small debt raise. If you look comparatively to the others in the space, which look, this is, as in the small cap market, things don't they don't track, rationally. So it's hard to get your story out. It's hard to find an audience of real investors who are looking at a company or looking at a company and saying, oh my God, you look at the trajectory of a company that within.
Colmena Seguros presenta una historia imparable.
Cuando uno de mis trabajadores sufrió un accidente en la empresa, sentí miedo. Pensaba en él, en su familia y en todo lo que podía pasar. Pero la verdad, ese miedo duró poco, porque Colmena Seguros estuvo a nuestro lado, guiándonos y acompañándonos para que la recuperación fuera más rápida. Hoy mi empresa sigue adelante, con la tranquilidad y respaldo de Colmena.
Colmena Seguros, la aseguradora de las empresas que no paran de salir adelante.
Vigilado Superintendencia Financiera de Colombia. Colmena Seguros, una empresa de Fundación Grupo Social.
12 months basically goes from zero to, I don't want to give the number out on, you know, we should all let Justin talk about it as far as the financials go. But, you know, in 12 months, you know, you've built a product, a business that's now servicing the largest companies in the world, and comparable to the other companies within the space, we are trading now at, you know, I think, being conservative, 20% of the value that a lot of these other companies are getting, whether or not they're private or they're public or they've just been taken out or they're financed. But, you know, we didn't mention this, but being a small, you know, we did come out, we're based in Toronto. So, you know, we come from a capital markets, a smaller capital market kind of pool, obviously resource driven, and you know, the market in Canada is interested in digging holes and smoking weed is kind of the big active markets. But in the US, you know, you have a real tech following. So with us, you know, the plan is now the company's kind of scaled up. You know, we're now looking for funding, you know, with the contracts that we've closed and the I would say profile of the clients. You know, we've got a pretty strong case that our company is well undervalued. And so our real goal on that level obviously is to uplist onto likely you know, preferably onto the NASDAQ, and get proper situated on a on the exchange in the US. So that's what's happening from a corporate level. And of course, you know, we right now, I can tell you, you know, we're all run off our feet. Us as Scribe, as the parent company, we spun the company out, as I mentioned, about a year ago. And, in that process, you know, there's a bit of a handoff, a vending over kind of, process. And just based on, you know, the resource needs, from a people perspective, the commercial, you know, activity that came in, you know, we've signed or the company signed, we're a partner with something called Project Arrow, which is a all electric, vehicle, you know, that's sponsored by, the provincial government, in Ontario. You know, we've, been endorsed by certain intelligence organizations. We've shown up, or we've been mentioned at quite a few White House, you know, a couple different White House, whatever you call it, you know, discussions or committees looking at, you know, how to properly get everybody on track here. So we're playing with the big boys, but being situated in a smaller country has been a bit of a challenge. And that's really from an opportunity as a company, that's really where we sit now. This market is on fire, and it's growing every day. Like Jackie says, you know, these companies are all, you know, they're all tardy at doing this stuff, but when the government or the FDA comes out and says, hey, look, you're not going to get FDA approval unless you file it with an SBOM. And by the way, if you don't provide an active, a current SBOM, you know, within a number of days after a change, you know, an upgrade in your software, we have the right to, you know, to pull that approval. You know, these big companies move pretty fast. You know, it's pretty impressive. Sometimes too fast. So that's from a high level answering your question where we are, Nick. I think, I don't know if I missed anything, Justin, really to hit the nail on the head there.
Yeah, it was really interesting. My prior job before I kind of ended up in this area of work was research regulation. And I know that they were pretty stringent on data protection in terms of like HIPAA. But as far as, you know, the research data, et cetera, it didn't seem to have anywhere near the protections that it should have. So it's really interesting to see things finally developing toward that end. So kind of what I want to do here, coming up on a little over an hour total of our panel, is I want to kind of kick it around here and see from you folks if there's anything we didn't touch on you want to give a quick blurb about. And of course, if there's anything Sybeats related that we didn't quite get to that you'd like to discuss before we send folks off into their afternoons, please do. So let's start here with Jackie and then kick it around to Justin and Clark.
Hey, I'm not sure that I have quite, you know, something like a closing statement or something, but maybe something to leave folks with to think about. I'm going to read from a book by Bruce Schneier, a security professional that I follow. He wrote this book in 2013. It's called Liars and Outliers, Enabling the Trust that Society Needs to Thrive. And I promote this book not because I know Bruce or because we're friendly or anything like that. We aren't. I do know him. We aren't. But because his ideas are so valuable and powerful. In this book, he talks about these social dilemmas that we find ourselves in every day and how we use trust as kind of a shorthand for how to work with each other. And there are four basic categories of societal pressure that he talks about that are intended to induce cooperation in these societal dilemmas. One of those is moral pressure. Another one is reputational pressure. A third one is institutional pressure. And a fourth one is security systems, right? Security systems are a form of societal pressure that are designed to induce cooperation and prevent defection, induce trust, and compel compliance. That's really what I think, you know, Sybeats falls into, the S-bombs, that kind of procedural kind of compliance component that goes along with the institutional pressures of rules and laws that we have in our society. All of these pieces work together to make us stronger. And so I think cybersecurity being a team sport, it's really valuable for more and more people to get involved, to think about not just their own personal security, but what they could be doing in their own roles, in their own lives, in their communities to make us all safer.
Thank you, Jackie. Very well said. And I mean, I wouldn't have anything to add to that. I think that's a really good way to put things.
I would say just, you know, a couple, you know, she again, obviously, is right in line. I think the two things that, I would leave, you know, I would leave you with to think about, that's been kind of, you know, notable in my world is, you know, number one, look out for the group, or for the, you know, the public officials. This is a problem that needs solving or needs solutions. From the top level, you know, it's not something, you know, when we're talking and look, there's obviously businesses and personal security that you can take care of. But where we're talking here about a matter of national security and we're talking about, you know, real high level manipulation, it's about the government. And, you know, I'll tell you, we have a partnership with APMA, which is Auto Parts Manufacturers Association in Canada. Obviously very tied in with all the manufacturers and the, you know, in talking and getting just, you know, I guess, secondhand information, you know, you can see it yourself. I mean, auto manufacturers, you know, the cars that we buy, they don't have cybersecurity on them. They've got about, I don't know, the average car has probably got 15 computers on it now and they're damn near all connected. But they don't have security, or they don't have the security they should. And they're not ready over the next 5 years with things going. They're not ready to adopt, and they obviously have to adopt solutions that are on this continent. You know, if it's not Canada or the United States, obviously, if it's not Canada, other solutions are compromised, and that's something that's shared by the top kind of security officials in the U.S. And so support, you know, keep an eye out, support anybody, I would say, in the public that's supporting that, number one. Number two, the next wave and the big wave, and this is not only from a, you know, situational personal risk, and I'll tell you, like, without sensationalizing things, cybersecurity over the next 15 years, if you're going to be alive there, especially, you know, you're going to have kids, you're at kid age and you're going to have a family or whatever, it's going to be a something to worry about, just like having access and having security from a a geopolitical perspective of being in a country that's not going to be under attack or whatever. You're going to want to be in areas that take care of their cybersecurity and make sure that you as a citizen is protected. Number two, AI. AI and the use of AI systems is a, I see Jackie there. She just throws up a 100 sign there. AI, it's fabulous. Everybody's excited. I stay up all night playing with, ChatGPT, making strange photos on the photo generator. It's amazing. It's fun stuff. But, you know, that's why, Jackie, you got to take the mute off, because when I say goofy stuff,
I just love your hemming and hawing. You're like, I'll make it some interesting photos here.
You get crazy. It's amazing. You get lost. Have you played with it?
I have. Yeah. So actually, I'm also an artist on the Solana blockchain. I make one for one NFT art. Not like 10,000 ape collections, but like individual pieces of digital art. And I've been just learning so much about, AI, how to use these different components and how to put them together. And I think, like, to your point, you have to be AI enabled moving forward. Cybersecurity folks have to be AI enabled. I see at least one person in the audience that I've had this actual conversation with within the last 2 weeks about how AI enablement is going to drive a lot of change, but it isn't going to necessarily replace people, right? The job of cybersecurity is a person-focused job, and we can't really be eliminated in that way.
Well, not yet. It's actually a new problem, right? It's a new issue, and in a big, big, big way. That's where we are. On the scribe level, we've entered into some things on that side, but. When you consider the risks that present themselves when you have an organization that has multiple AI systems all connected to each other, learning systems, and also tied into the network, and how do those work together? How are they? What security do you have that these things are not literally like a movie going to come out and do something crazy? I'll tell you, we hear that from on the committees that we're on with the federal government. We obviously ask, what's the next thing that you guys are worried about? Where can we build some technology and possibly solve a problem and make some money? And unilaterally, we've heard, this wave of, and we were actually, Cybeats was just mentioned at the White House launch on AI, talk of AI security and AI compliance. Jackie, it's a crazy situation. I don't know how much you're in that, but it's a scary one. It's like literal science fiction movie type stuff.
It is. But at the same time, I think we can develop a rational perspective to it using the experiences of the past and understanding what the, like if we perform an after action review, I come from the military as a veteran. So I tend to use the after action review as a useful rubric, right? For just trying to figure out what went right, what went wrong, what can we do better next time?
For sure. It's also about compliance. It's like if we let AI run, unmanaged, like we have just the use of software on products, it wouldn't take long to be a serious problem. And I'm a huge supporter of it. That's what Scribe's into now. That's the next platform that we're working on. But what I would say is, so aside from obviously being supporting, officials and companies that are out there with solutions that are going to keep you safer, get thinking about AI, get researching it. It's going to be and not AI is the buzzword, which it's been for the last 3 years, where you throw it on anything and these public companies, bullshit public companies, string three buzzwords together,
add AI, instant VC funds.
yeah, crypto AI ventures. Oh my God, Jesus Christ. You can't get your,
that sounds awesome.
Your wallet out faster. Really educate yourself a little bit on AI, and there's going to be an opportunity for investors. I think there's going to be for real companies and identifying them, and you know it's not easy doing it, but for risk capital, if you know, for guys that like buying stock or like investing on the VC side, I mean, I think VCs are a whole other bag of tricks, but for guys that want to invest in small cap stocks, risk stocks, the cybersecurity space in certain sectors has a lot of fruit to bear, in my opinion. This is in its infancy, right? So the reason that a lot of these companies are getting these crazy valuations is that these problems are so large that if you can come up with a solution to solve them, you know, you're going to have a license to print money and build value. The same thing goes for AI. So stick in there, and obviously it's part of a shameless plug. That's what we do, and I'm deeply invested myself and support everything that we do, and I'm a strong believer. I also personally, you know, I think everybody should be somewhat emotionally involved with what they do if they have that opportunity to be you know, behind what they do. These are serious things, guys. They're absolutely serious. It is an opportunity, but it's also something look for elected officials to get this going. And you know, it's going to be hard to put a social any social aspect to it to get the PRs behind it, but it's a big one.
Yeah, I would just bridge something that both of you brought forward here is that people take an interest in this kind of thing. We've got that government pressure, you know, that institutional pressure through the regulation that's happened, you know, that's really helped prime the pump for us. But if people actually care about what is in their software, then that is going to add another layer of pressure on the companies that have taken responsibility for providing it, enjoy all the benefits, but don't always actually know what's in there, which exposes not just them, but all of us as individuals to those vulnerabilities. So I think it makes sense to bring another level of pressure as well, and ensuring and, you know, demanding that there's some transparency into what's actually in our software.
A lot of really good things there to wrap us up, especially those comments on AI. I definitely agree with all of you on that. I mean, the thing that really kind of blew my mind was in Asia this week, somebody got away with like a $25 million heist using deepfakes, like for video calls and everything, impersonating a CEO. It's pretty wild. So, I mean, once again, obviously, thank you guys so much for sponsoring this space. Again, that's Cybeats. And we had Justin here, he's the CEO at Cybeats, and Clark here, who is the president of Scribe. And if you want to learn more about what they're doing in SBOM, you can head directly over to their website, cybeats.com, CYBEATS.com. A lot of really good information there, full breakdowns of what they're doing and what they're working on. And
Nick,
of course, yeah.
I have to interrupt because, you know, you're a smart guy. I listened to a lot of these. And obviously, once we got connected, I went back. How have you not given me shit about my name? How have you not said, you know?
I've been withholding the whole time. I'll be honest with you.
What a joke. I thought this guy's a real professional that he hasn't hammered me on that. Thank you so much, Nick. Really appreciate it. Jackie, wonderful talking with you. I'd love to see, and I don't have to participate, but I would absolutely love to see one of these on AI, and actually one of these with software or on software security or whatever. But get some congressmen on here, get some government guys on here, because I want to hear what they know and their perspective. And there's a reason to get a groundswell behind pushing this type of an agenda. So I'm a big supporter. Love it. Love Unusual Whale. Absolutely doing the right thing, bringing transparency to what we do. We're big transparency fans. Jackie, wrap it up. Tell us you want the same.
I think everybody's awesome. I'm glad to learn about your organization today, to learn about what's been happening in that space. You know, I haven't been keeping up on the latest trends from a corporate perspective, because I haven't been working a corporate job recently, just doing private consulting and focusing on my artwork. You know, I just want to leave everyone with a positive thought that, you know, cybersecurity is a team sport. If we work together, we can make it better. And that even if you don't have a specific role where you have a title that relates to cybersecurity in some way, you're always responsible for yourself, for your own threat modeling, and for getting a sense of who you are, what assets or accesses you have, what types of people might be interested in them, and what tactics they've been known to use previously to obtain those, and what you're going to do in response to defend yourself. I hope that that's a useful takeaway for everyone on the call today.
Where do we see your art?
At 0x Graffito on the Solana blockchain. I'm on several different sites. I'm going to plug Drip House. Drip House is the most amazing platform. If you don't know anything about Web3, it's probably a really great place to start. Pick up a Solana wallet, install the Phantom or Backpack wallet extensions that you use with your browser, and you can get free art delivered every week. I produce art that goes out to 60,000 wallets. So wow. It's just so fun. I'm having so much fun, and I'm producing works that relate to the stuff that I do in cyber, to the conversations that I have about privacy. And it gives me this really wonderful outlet. So I also suggest that everyone on the call find outlets and things that really make you feel good. And if it makes you feel stressed to hear about these topics, to learn about the erosions of privacy, you know, greater surveillance in our society, low cybersecurity regimes, low data privacy regimes, just know that, you know, there are people who care. There are people who are working on it and making it better. And you should find ways to fill your cup. So whatever you can do to contribute to that cause is super helpful and valuable. Even just showing up to a space like this today is awesome. Thank you.
Beautifully put, Jackie. Thank you. Again, everybody, thank you once again to Justin and Clark and to Cybeats for sponsoring our space. You can check out more about them at cybeats.com. And obviously a big thank you once again to Jackie for joining us here and lending us her expertise as well. You can check more of her work out at hackingbutlegal.com. So everybody, that'll wrap us up on the CyberSec space. I hope everybody has a great rest of their day. Thanks again to Jackie and the Cybeats boys. Clark Kent might not save you from crime, but he can help you protect yourself from cyber attacks.
Colmena Seguros presenta una historia imparable.
Cuando uno de mis trabajadores sufrió un accidente en la empresa, sentí miedo. Pensaba en él, en su familia y en todo lo que podía pasar. Pero la verdad, ese miedo duró poco, porque Colmena Seguros estuvo a nuestro lado, guiándonos y acompañándonos para que la recuperación fuera más rápida. Hoy mi empresa sigue adelante, con la tranquilidad y respaldo de Colmena.
Colmena Seguros, la aseguradora de las empresas que no paran de salir adelante.
Vigilado Superintendencia Financiera de Colombia. Colmena Seguros, una empresa de Fundación Grupo Social.